Welcome to a one-night stand with the big band. It's most appropriate that Let's Dance, the famed theme song of the King of Swing, Benny Goodman, introduces our one-night stand, the May edition. This is Arnold Dane, and our guest this time will be the world's foremost authority on the big band era, George T. Simon. And tonight, it'll be a panoramic view of the representative bands of that tremendous big band era. Tonight's one-night stand with the big bands will be brought to you by Russo Chevrolet and Windsor Locks, where you'll find special low spring sale prices on beautiful new Chevy models and on reliable used cars. And by WTIC. Welcome to a one-night stand with the big bands. Harry James Music Makers. More about that in a moment. Russo Chevrolet wants this coming summer to be the best summer you've ever had. The summer you see the USA in a beautiful new Chevy. That's why they're offering special spring sale prices on all their beautiful new Chevy models. Many young families are getting carried away by Chevelle. Others prefer the Impala, a car that starts you relaxing before you get where you're going. Or what about the sporty Camaro? the economical Nova, or one of the many handy wagons. Stop in and talk to an experienced Russo salesman. He knows his product, and he'll be happy to show you the features of all the exciting new Chevrolet models. You'll be buying a fine car at special spring sale prices from a dealer who cares about you after the sale. 13 certified mechanics will keep your car in top running condition. Make 1972 your year for Chevy and for Russo Chevrolet. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo. That's R-U-S-S-O. Russo Chevrolet, directly across from Bradley International in Windsor Locks. And now, let's converse with George T. Simon here in the living room of his comfortable home in Stamford, Connecticut. George, as we said, we opened with Music Makers by Harry James. Why did you pick that particular one?
Arnold, I guess because you said, what do you like about Harry James? And right away, I started thinking about just the easy, relaxed style that he has and the happy feeling that the band gets. And Music Maker seems to typify it. And of course, everybody knows it. And I know when you start a program, you like to catch everybody's ear with something they know. So I thought Music Makers might be fun.
His band sounds very much the same way today as it did back in, when was it, 39 that he went out on his
own?
Yeah,
I heard it in Roseland just a few weeks ago. And on April 24th, I believe it was, he was down there. Mm-hmm. And it was just fantastic. The band is a swinging band still. He's got Sonny Payne on drums, and Harry's playing as great as ever.
And he's had Corky Corcoran with him on tenor saxophone for, I guess, about 104 years now or so. They've been together a long time.
Corky's beautiful. And a great baseball fan. Both of them, you know, care more about the St. Louis Cardinals, I think, than they do about playing.
They've had some problems over the years, then, as far as baseball is concerned. What about the James Band? Was it the success of Benny Goodman at Carnegie Hall that finally prompted the move for Harry to go out on his own?
No, I don't think... Harry told me the reason he actually left the band. It's a very interesting story. He said that the reason he left the band was because he couldn't stand playing Sing, Sing, Sing anymore. He said, believe it or not, he said he had a real hang-up about that, a psychological hang-up about Sing, 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 and he used to go into absolute panic. He doesn't know what caused it. And one time he just couldn't get up and play it all, and Ziggy had to nudge him, and nothing happened, so Ziggy had to jump up and take the chorus. And Harry said it happened one time because he'd been sick, and they had given them some sulfur drugs. In those days, sulfur drugs were very new, and they weren't very controlled. And apparently he had a bad reaction. And on the basis of that, every time he came to the same place and Sing, 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 that tom-tom effect and everything, he'd get all panicky, breaking down into a cold sweat. And he said, he told Benny about that, and Benny was very sympathetic and said, I understand, but I got to play the thing. And Harry said, I understand it too, because, you know, it's your big number. So finally, Harry said the only thing for him to do was to have his own band. And the funny part was, he said, after a while, the same reaction started to take place when he played You Made Me Love You all the time.
You know, that brings up a point which must have bugged a lot of great jazz musicians over the years. I know Glenn Miller insisted that a soloist, say Tex Beneke, play in personal appearances the same sax solo that he'd played when they made the recording.
Right.
And this must have been a terrible drag for highly imaginative and inventive musicians.
It drove them up the wall. Like I'm doing a book now, you know, on Glenn Arnold, and I found out more and more that the one complaint that the musicians who worked for him had was the fact that everything was so Boy Scoutish in that respect. Uh-huh. And, you know, despite the fact this was a fantastic band, a wonderfully musical band, they still had trouble in playing inspired music because of the fact that they had to do so many things exactly the same way. Glenn was a fantastic businessman, a fantastic organizer, and he didn't give his men too many leeways.
George, you've written, a number of books and I guess a few million articles over the years. Your book, The Big Bands, is one that we refer to, I think, constantly. I don't know if we could ever do one of these shows without referring to it. And your later book, which is that huge, tremendous work, compilation of your articles for Metronome Magazine, but updated with some comments from some of the leaders that you talk about. How are the sales going?
You mean the Simon Says book?
Yes.
Yeah. They're doing very nicely, thank you. The book is an expensive book, as you once said to me, and also it's a heavy book. I think Leonard Feather said, the book is harder to pick up than it is to put down, which is a nice line.
It's a tremendous work, though. It sums up the whole era. And you say you're working now on a Glenn Miller book.
Yes.
What will this be about?
This will be called Glenn Miller. It's a whole biography of Glenn from the very beginning. I've gotten all sorts of wonderful cooperation from Glenn Miller fans all over the world. And also the estate has given me carte blanche to go into the Miller files and go through all this correspondence and everything. And I'm finding out some fascinating things about the man as a human being.
There's no one in the world better qualified to write about Glenn Miller than George T. Simon, because you were with him right at the very beginning. As a matter of fact, you played with his band, played drums with him for a while.
Matter of fact, Arnold was right around this area. It was up in Cornwall, which is
Cromwell.
Cromwell.
Cromwell. Uh-huh. Cromwell. McIntyre's
there. Yeah, right outside of Merton, isn't it?
Yes.
Glenn and I, on a very cold winter's night in early 1937, or late 1936, drove up there to hear Hal's band. John Hammond had told us about Hal, and Hal wanted Glenn to take the entire band as his nucleus. And we went up there, and we didn't like, or Glenn didn't like the band that much, but he loved Hal's playing, and he loved Hal personally. And Hal was the first guy he hired.
Didn't Miller at one time tell you that you would have to decide between being a music critic and being a drummer?
Yeah,
you had to go one way or the other.
That's right. And that, fortunately, by that time, I'd heard the records I'd made with him.
And that helped you with
helped
your decision.
Helped me decide to stay on as a writer, yeah.
Of all the Glenn Miller bands, which was your favorite?
Oh, the Army Air Force Band, far and away. That was a fantastic band.
It was a huge band,
A huge band, but yet when you take the band without the strings, which was just about the same instrumentation as he had with his civilian band, there's absolutely no comparison to me with the bands, with the musicianship, the excitement and everything, the originality, the soloists, everything. Well, of course, it was a hand-picked band.
Yes.
Good Lord, the guys he had in that band were unbelievable. Bernie Priven out of Artie Shaw's band, and Bobby Nichols was a great young trumpet player who had just been with Vaughn Monroe, and Zeke Zarchi, who had been with Glenn and had also been with Benny Goodman and Bob Crosby, and then Steve Steck, who had been with Benny Goodman, with the trumpet players. There were several other trumpet players in the band who played on and off. Whitey Thomas was another one. And then the saxophone players, Peanuts Hucko, who played such great clarinet, and Hank Freeman out of Artie Shaw's band. Mel Powell was on piano, and Ray McKinley on drums, and Carmen Mashburn from Tommy Dorsey's band on guitar, and Trigger Alpert out of Glenn's band on bass. So, my God, what a rhythm section that
was. Oh, it's just tremendous, George. That's true. Let me pick a favorite, if I can. A favorite of many people from Glenn Miller's AAF band. You remember the St. Louis Blues March?
Now you can have a beautiful, low-mileage 1971 Chevrolet at a price almost too good to believe. It's spring sale time at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. And Russo has 40, that's right, 40 low-mileage 71 Chevys ready and waiting for you. You'll find two- and four-door Impalas, two- and four-door Malibus, Novas, just about every 1971 Chevy model. Some have factory air conditioning, and all carry Russo's own 12,000-mile written warranty. Ask Russo for details. Stop in, look them over. Then buy, knowing that when you buy a Russo used car, you're buying a car that's been completely reconditioned, a car you can rely on. Russo takes pride in the quality of its cars and of its service. Remember, that's low-mileage 1971 Chevrolets, 40 of them. Spring sale price now at Russo. That's R-U-S-S-O, Russo Chevrolet. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo Chevrolet, directly across from Bradley International in Windsor Locks. George, what years do you consider the golden era of the big bands?
Well, I'd say 35 to 46, actually 12
okay.
years. Beginning middle of 35 when Benny first started at the Palomar in Los Angeles, and the end of 1936 when about eight bands all gave up at one time.
In one month, as I recall.
It's sort of, it really overlaps both ends tremendously. But if people ask me to define the era of the big bands, I sort of choose those. So I'm sure a lot of people will argue with me about that, because certainly there were many big bands before Goodman ever got there, and there were many big bands after 1946.
One of the reasons that the big band started going out of business, I think, was at the end of World War II, the vocalists came more and more into their prime. Frank Sinatra, for example, was a name by himself. He didn't need the whole Tommy Dorsey orchestra and so on.
Joe Stafford didn't either, you know, and many others. Dick Hames didn't need the Harry James name anymore. And there were all sorts of them. Perry Como didn't need Tab Weems. I think there were various reasons for that. One was just the tenor of the times when the kids became more sentimental because their boyfriends were away. Mm-hmm. And then also, I don't think that many of the musicians wanted to go out on the road after having been in the Army. They wanted to stay home. It was hard getting the musicians to go out on the road. The economics were quite different. Prices started going up. It was the bands were demanding more money, and also the terrible, terrible strike at the Musicians Union had pulled for 2 years gave the vocalists a chance to record and didn't give the bands a chance to record. And what records did come out by the bands was stuff that they'd hold out of the bottom of the barrel, which was not very good, stuff that very often the bands didn't want to have released, but they had to have something come out. So they released some very inferior stuff. And some of the bands were very inferior, too, because they were manned by inexperienced musicians, because they either get kids who were too young to be in the Army or else guys who were too drunk to go into the Army, and they'd have a bad mixture of bands very often.
When you talk over vocalists, there's one name that I think is really legendary and stands out against most of the others, stands out well above them, and that's Billie Holiday.
Oh, gee, what a singer she was. Yeah. And, you know, she never sang with bands very much. She did sing with Artie Shaw for several months, which a lot of people don't know. I was one of the first black singers ever to sing with a white band. Lena Horne, I think, sang with Charlie Barnett a little before then. And she also sang with Basie. But she never recorded with Basie, and she made only one record with Artie Shaw. But she was a fantastic singer, and I never knew her personally very well. I'm very sorry that I didn't, because she was a fascinating lady, of course. But for some reason or other, our paths never crossed that much, maybe because she was not with bands and I was always concentrating so much on bands. But, of course, I heard her many times on 52nd Street, and those records she made with Teddy Wilson and later on under her own name, you know, are just gems.
What set her off from the others?
I think the great emotional impact that she had in her voice, the great feeling, the fact she didn't hold back at all. And, of course, she was a stylist, a tremendous stylist. And she had a legitimate cry in her voice, in her phrasing. You know, she really, when she was blue and people knew it.
Yes.
And there was nothing at all stiff about her singing. It was all very, very personal, a very personal approach to her style. And, of course, jazz-wise, she had fantastic inflections and a tremendous beat. That I never forget that one record, the first record that the Teddy Wilson band ever made on its own, which had Billy, which still to me is one of the swingiest records of all time. This is the one that had Benny Goodman came along to help Teddy inaugurate his first date, and had Roy Eldridge on trumpet and Ben Webster on tenor sax, Teddy on piano, of course, John Trueheart out of Chick Webb's band, and John Kirby out of Chick Webb's band on guitar and bass, and Cozy Cole on drums. And now, you know that record, the Miss Brown to You record, which is, I think, is one of the great records of all time, both for Benny, both for Billy, and for the whole band. It's just a fantastic piece of work.
Listening to A One-Night Stand with the Big Bands with our guest, Big Band Authority George T. Simon, coming to you on 1080 Radio. This is WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut. This is Arnold Dane, and our One-Night Stand with the Big Bands is being brought to you by Russo Chevrolet and Windsor Locks, where you'll find special low spring sale prices on beautiful new Chevy models and on reliable used cars, and by WTIC.
George, we talked a while ago about the fact that you consider the big band era, for your own specifications, 1935 to 46, but there are many who would argue that the big band era started much earlier than that. And, well, I think of a name like Bix Beiderbecke, one of the early trumpet players.
Actually, if it all depends what you mean by the era. I guess I mean the popularity era of the big bands was 1935 to 46, but there were many, many big bands then. Not many, there were several. Art Hickman and Paul Whiteman, of course. Paul Whiteman was a tremendously influential man. And, of course, in the 20s, Duke Ellington started his band, the great Gene Golkett band, and the band that so few people talk about, which I think is one of the stupendous bands of all time, McKinney's Cotton Pickers, which was with Don Redman. And, of course, it was Fletcher Henderson's band. They were there. And later on, in the late 20s, Hal Kemp started coming along with a great jazz band which featured Bunny Berrigan on trumpet for a while, you know. And Casaloma came along, and Ray Noble came along, and there were a lot of other sweet bands like Leo Reisman and bands like that. There were plenty of bands around, but my feeling is that they didn't take hold with the public until the mid-30s.
How much influence did somebody like Bix have on those trumpet players who were to follow?
Oh, Bix didn't have as much influence as Louis Armstrong did, by any means. But he certainly had an influence on guys like Jimmy McPartland and Red Nichols and some of the polite jazz trumpet players. Bobby Hackett, of course, was influenced by Bix tremendously. In a sense, Billy Butterfield and some of the pretty things he played were very much like Bix. Bix was certainly an original player. And he copied nobody, so far as I can say. And certainly was a character. He's sort of the prototype of all the people you hear about as the jazz musician who drinks too much and who's in a fog most of the time.
George, in your book, Simon Says, you have a whole section which is devoted to Bix Beiderbecke, the man, and some of the music that he made. And I know there are some tremendous quotes in there from Paul Whiteman.
Let me see if I can find it here a second.
It's a big book.
Oh, yes.
It takes some looking.
Blessing, here it is. Let me just take a part of it. I remember what he said here. You know, I'd say there was a sort of ethereal quality about Bix. You had the feeling that he was always in the air, especially when he was close to music. Somehow or other, he gave you the impression that he was constantly striving for something that was just out of his reach. His continual search for some sort of ultimate created almost a mystic halo about him. It gave you the feeling that here was a genius who knew of something beautiful to strive for, and that even though he might never reach it, he was far above you merely because he could sense that beauty for which he was reaching. But Eddie Condon knew him very well. Eddie Condon always had some wonderful things. Eddie said, Bix never bothered much about his horn or embouchure or any other stuff like that, the way so many trumpeters do too much nowadays. He was always losing his cornet or stepping on it. I can't remember how many horns he'd run through, but they were all the same to him. He just played. And it was really, as far as I can, I never met him, but as far as I can ascertain through all these interviews we did for, this was taken from an issue of Metronome devoted to Bix, as far as I can ascertain from all of that, he's a tremendous foggy guy who was devoted entirely to his music and nothing else. Bix was a very high-living guy. He drank an awful lot, and actually it was liquor that did him in, finally, just the way poor Bunny Berrigan. Two great trumpeters, both with the same initials, both with the same problem.
And both of them died very early. They were both in their 30s.
Yeah, the last time I heard Berrigan, as a matter of fact, was around here in Connecticut at a dance, and I couldn't believe how he disintegrated as a trumpet player. Mm-hmm. It's just pathetic.
And it's amazing that they've left such a mark. Now, here's a guy, Bix Beiderbecke, who died in his 30s. He was a relative unknown, a virtual unknown for all the years, except among jazz critics and the people who really knew music, his fellow musicians and so on.
Yeah.
And yet, look at the impact he made. They still study his techniques today.
By the way, you can't give Whiteman enough credit for the way he used to feature sidemen. In addition to Bix, he used to feature Tommy Dorsey and Jimmy Dorsey and Mildred Bailey and Bing Crosby and Joe Venuti and Eddie Lang. All these people, he was always building them up and giving them credit. And a lot of people think of Whiteman just as, you know, as an old fogey who was interested only in stage techniques and making a big sound, a lot of violins. But he encouraged so many jazz musicians. And one of them, of course, was Bix. And this record of Changes, which I think is a classical, and which, by the way, also has Bing Crosby on it with the Rhythm Boys, as I remember, is a great example of both Whiteman and Bix. Thank you.
hear that minor strain. Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
There's so many babies that he can squeeze, and he's always changing those keys.
First, he changes into B, changes into C, changes into D, changes into E. As easy as the weatherman. Getting kind of cold, getting kind of hot. Listen, I forgot, since he was a tot, he's been the talk of Dixieland.
I'm sure this will be one of the favorite moments of this entire show for George T. Simon, because being a great admirer of all the jazz bands over the years, we are going to talk now about Guy Lombardo, who certainly has been one of the outstanding big bands of all time.
He certainly has, and I've got to give a lot of credit to him for lasting as long as he has. And I think, you know, the sounds are great for those who like it. What more can I say?
Apparently,
what less can I say?
Apparently, many, many people have liked it, and over the years, you've not been a fan of Guy Lombardo.
I think I was in 1928 for a while, for about 3 or 4 days, but...
got over it quickly.
Yeah, I had his original, I think, a record of Goodnight Sweetheart. The first time I heard it, I liked it. But, you know, it's unfair, because what Lombardo is doing, he has perfected and marketed a fantastic commodity. And you really can't fault the man at all. He's just done a fantastic job within his own world. And it's a world which I don't relate to musically very well. Although I must say that a couple of years ago, Madison Square Garden, when they had a dance evening, dance band evening there, his band sounded awfully good compared with some of the other swing bands which didn't have such good musicianship in it. What Lombardo does, he does awfully well. But it just so happens that I don't like what he does, especially. And I don't think he likes what I write about him, especially, which I can't blame him. He didn't like the line, I remember. He didn't appreciate my line at all one time when I said his music was so soft and quiet that during the dinner session you could even hear a mashed potato drop.
This brings up a whole area. What about the role of a jazz critic? What do you feel your responsibilities are or have been?
Well, I've got very strong feelings about that, Arnold, because I think as a critic, you've got to criticize anything you're criticizing, any artist you're criticizing on the basis of what he's trying to do, and then criticize how well he's doing it. You can't go in there with preconceived opinions of what he should be doing and then criticize him because he's not doing what you feel he should be doing. And in that respect, I remember when I reviewed Lombardo's band, I reviewed it. We had a dual rating system in Metronome at that time. In fact, the original review is in Simon Says, and I'll read you his comments about my original review. There we had two rating systems, an alphabetical rating for musicianship and a numerical rating for commerciality. And with Lombardo's band, I gave him a straight C for musicianship, but a one, which is the highest rating I could, for commercialism.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what there are a few little unpleasant things, I'm sure, in the review, such as this reviewer belongs in the unappreciative class. He doesn't like his style. To him, the exaggerated sax vibratos, the clippity brass phrases with their illegitimate tones, the little use made of five rhythm instruments, and the style of singing that lets you hear all the consonants and no vowels. All of them comprise the type of music that he preferred to do without. And of course, that in this new edition of the Big Band's book, he said, he wrote, "You and I have had a hell of a lot of differences of opinion all of our lives. The trouble is that you have not studied the music business as you should. as a critic, you've just been picking up on eighth notes. It's a very funny line, I think. Although, you know, there are a lot of surprises here in regard to reactions to Lombardo. If you listen to Louis Armstrong records of the early 30s, you'll find a sax section that sounds very much like Lombardo's. And why did it sound like Lombardo's? Because Louis wanted them to sound that way. Mm-hmm. Louis, in an interview I did with him, referred to Lombardo as my inspirator. And he loved Lombardo's music. He was a great fan of Lombardo's. So, you know, who am I to say I don't like his music? One of the reasons he did so well was because he picked such great tunes. He was a great selector of tunes. And some of them were written by his brother Carmen, the late Carmen Lombardo. And one of them, which I always loved, was Sweethearts on Parade.
It takes more than one to join their army. How I pine just to fall in line with a sweetheart's on parade.
I think that was Sweethearts on Parade, wasn't it, George?
Yeah, and did you hear that mashed potato drop in the background? I couldn't hear it.
Now, that was not the only band that recorded that. Guy Lombardo, as a matter of fact, I didn't recall until you mentioned it that he had done Sweethearts on Parade. I always think of that Lionel Hampton recording
same. That's one of the great recordings of all time. The one with Chu Berry blowing his tenor all the way through from the opening, very opening to the very end. Chu never stops wailing. That's one of the... They're great records of all time.
Thank you. sweetheart on parade. How they smile as they pass me by, those sweethearts on parade. I'd love to join their fun, but they bar me. It takes more than one to make an army. Do-da-da-do-dee. How I find just to fall in line with the sweetheart on parade.
Chu Berry featured Lionel Hampton's Sweethearts on Parade. He's another of the tenor sax players that we idolize so much. He was killed in a traffic accident, also at a very tender age.
Yeah, and he was a fantastic player and so consistent. And, of course, you know, how he swung. And then, of course, he made those great records with Cab Calloway's band, Ghost of a Chance and things like that. He was a very emotional tenor saxophone player also. But this whole record is so typical of the things that Hampton was doing at that time. The great feeling of exuberance, the great happiness. You heard it in his vocal, and then the shuffle rhythm. It's very funny, they were playing a shuffle rhythm. Cozy Cole on drums was playing basically a shuffle rhythm, which a lot of people turn their noses down at, but it's when it's used correctly, it's a swinging type of rhythm. And I can't get over the way Chu just keeps on wailing in this thing all the way through. Hamp did so many things at that time with so many great musicians. There was one record session, he used to take various guys into the studio. He'd get all the top musicians to make these records with him. This is before he had his own set band. He was still with Benny Goodman at the time, but he made dates with pickup bands all the time. And on one date, he had, in addition to Chu Berry, Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, and Benny Carter on sax.
Wow.
Like, where could you find a sax section like that? It was just unbelievable.
Tremendous.
And, of course, Hampton is such a... His enthusiasm is so contagious.
He's still active, too, isn't he, George?
Oh, yeah,
he's still
very
playing.
Active. He's very active. He's very active in the Israeli movement. He's tremendously dedicated to Israel, and he's also tremendously dedicated to Nixon, but he's a staunch Republican.
And he's one musician from the big band era for whom they will never have to hold any benefits.
Yes, I'm sure of that, yeah. And Lionel is just a beautiful cat. He hasn't changed one bit in all the years I've known him. And that's since 1936 when he first joined Benny. That's 36 years ago, yeah. Still exactly the same.
Now let's stand by for just a moment, if you will, George, and then perhaps we can talk about a band that I'm sure is a favorite of both of us, Tommy Dorsey. But first, Russo Chevrolet wants this coming summer to be the best summer you've ever had. The summer you see the USA in a beautiful new Chevy. That's why they're offering special spring sale prices on all their beautiful new Chevy models. Many young families are getting carried away by Chevelle. Others prefer the Impala, a car that starts you relaxing before you get where you're going. Or what about the sporty Camaro, the economical Nova, or one of the many handy wagons? Stop in and talk to the experienced Russo salesman. He knows his product, and he'll be happy to show you the features of all the exciting new Chevrolet models. You'll be buying a fine car,
at special spring sale prices from a dealer who cares about you after the sale. 13 certified mechanics will keep your car in top running condition. Make 1972 your year for Chevy and for Russo Chevrolet. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo. That's R-U-S-S-O, Russo Chevrolet, directly across from Bradley International in Windsor Locks. Now, George, I've always considered Tommy Dorsey's to be just about the most versatile of all the big bands. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it is the most versatile band. I think that band could do more things well than any other band, with the possible exception of Claude Thornhill's, I think. That was also a fantastic all-around band. But Tommy, like Paul Whiteman, whom we talked about some time back, Dorsey also did so much for the people and had sense enough to let the people who were talented in his band really come through. Mm-hmm. And that's why he had this succession of great singers like, you know, Jack Leonard first, and then Frank Sinatra and Joe Stafford, and then later on a guy I happen to love, Stuart Forster, who was such a great singer. And these great musicians in his early band, he had Bunny Berrigan and Davy Tough and Bud Freeman and Johnny Mintz and Pee Wee Irwin. And then later on, of course, he had Bunny again and Ziggy Elman and Buddy Rich and Joey Bushkin and
Buddy DeFranco.
And Buddy DeFranco and so many people. And, of course, he himself was such a great musician and such a wonderful man to work for. The guys used to love to work for Tommy, even though he could be very rough. He was a little different from Glenn Miller. He was a disciplinarian the way Glenn was in many ways, but not all the time. Mm-hmm. And there were times when he let the guys do whatever they wanted to do on the bandstand almost. And I remember he used to love to have Bud Freeman play something like 10 or 12 solos in a row. And poor Bud. And Tommy would stand there laughing. And he'd hold up one finger and Bud would be panting for breath. And Tommy would hold up, you know, for one more chorus. And poor Bud was out on his feet and the guys in the band would be breaking up. But Tommy encouraged his musicians tremendously and had a lot of fun on the bandstand and also off the bandstand. He socialized with them a great deal, much more so than most leaders did. He'd have them out to his home and do all sorts of things with them. And there was a great, great enthusiasm in that band, and it came through in its music, of course.
We played some of your favorites during the course of the show tonight, George. I wonder if we could play one of mine, "Well Get It" by Tommy Dorsey. Such a swinging number.
Oh, I'm glad you selected, because if you hadn't, I think I would have, Arnold, because that's such a wild thing, especially with those two trumpets, when Ziggy and Chuck Peterson. That's a fantastic excitement.
Tremendous.
Buddy plays so great in this thing, too.
As usual, yes. "Well Get It" by Tommy Dorsey. Our guest on a one-night stand with the big bands has been a well-known author and the man that we always say has written more and knows more about the big bands than anybody else. Author of the book, The Big Bands, and also more recently, Simon Says, and voluminous other works, George T. Simon. George, it's always a pleasure. There's so much that we have left to talk about. We'll do so on future shows.
Great, Arnold, and it's so much fun to talk to you always because you have such a great feel for this music. And by the way, on behalf of so many of us who love big bands, thanks for all you and the station have been doing. It's been great.
Our location engineer was Ben Zinkerman. Our studio engineer, Bob Schirago. This program was produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. Our next one-night stand with the big bands will be heard on Wednesday, June 7th, 1972, from 9:05 until 10 p.m. And our special guest will be the great cornet trumpet artist, Bobby Hackett. Tonight's one-night stand with the big bands, featuring the world's foremost authority on the big band era, George T. Simon, was brought to you by Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks, where you'll find special low spring sale prices on beautiful new Chevy models and on reliable used cars, and by WTIC. This is Arnold Dean.